I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
A 3-year battle over executive privilege reached the Supreme Court today as the Bush administration asked that the records of Vice President Dick Cheney's 2001 Energy Task Force remain private. The case is an appeal from a federal court decision 2 years ago when the White House was ordered to begin turning over documents from the task force. Professor Charles Shaner teaches law at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor joins us now. Welcome, Professor.
Or afternoon.
Professor Shaner, welcome to you. Solicitor General Ted Olson's presenting the Bush administration case. What will be the core of his argument?
The core of his argument is certainly that the Constitution gives the administration the power to gather together information and make decisions without having to reveal all aspects of what goes into the decision to outsiders.
And what is the reasoning behind that?
Well, some of the reasoning is simply premised upon some fairly obscure constitutional provisions, the Recommendations Clause and the Opinion Clause. The former says that the president can inform Congress and recommend measures to them, and certainly a number of legislative initiatives came out of the Energy Policy Commission. The Opinion Clause essentially says that he can give his opinions on a variety of matters, and those within the administration can give their opinions to him.
All right. Who's arguing the case then on the other side, and what is their argument?
Well, the other side essentially is a judicial a variety of organizations, I should say. All of whom have an interest in...
Like the Sierra Club is one of those organizations.
The Sierra Club is one. There are a couple of environmental defense groups, and there's just a variety of public interest organizations, I think, would cover the field.
And what will they be telling the Supreme Court?
They're going to be saying that, there's no constitutional protection here, either because the administration is either premature or too late in asserting such considerations, or two, that the administration is simply wrong as a matter of the scope of those clauses. Essentially, as I understand it, their argument is that a variety of energy officials from the private sector were de facto members of the Energy Policy Advisory Group.
And they influence the policy.
Well, it's permissible for them to influence the policy informally, but as I read it, the allegation says that they were so involved and so influential, may have even voted on particular policy matters, at least that's the allegation, that they ought to be considered members of the committee. And when people outside government become members of such committees, then there's a federal statute that kicks in, the Federal Advisory Committee Act. And they say under that act, then the records become open to all.
Professor Charles Shaner teaches law at Emory University in Atlanta. Professor, thanks very much for joining us.
Good to talk with you.
Last night, Jordanian state television aired confessions from 4 men alleged to be part of a terror plot that the government of Jordan says would have been more devastating than the September 11th attacks in the U.S. Jordanian security forces claim the terrorists planned to use truck bombs and chemical weapons and that their plot could have killed as many as 80,000 civilians in the capital. And they put the accused terrorists on TV. Here's what the nightly news in English sounded like last night.
Good evening and welcome to the news. First, the headlines. His Majesty the King stresses that understanding what makes people terrorists is the way to thwart future attacks. Plotters of terrorist attacks in Jordan that would have left thousands of people killed make televised confessions on the details of their attacks.
Joining us on the line from Amman, Jordan, is freelance reporter Kristen Gillespie. Welcome, Kristen.
Hi, Robin.
We'll hear more of the confessions in a moment, but first, how did Jordanians react to seeing this footage on their television screens?
Before the documentary aired, people were really skeptical about the government's claims because all the information that's been reported to that point before the documentary aired was from the government only. There were supposedly booby-trapped cars. There was supposedly a chemical bomb. But we didn't see any evidence of this. We didn't see the cars themselves or the chemicals. Last night, there was footage of the booby-trapped cars, trucks, the chemicals, and we saw interviews with the accused terrorists as well. Once that aired, people changed their minds. And I'd say public opinion is split 50-50. Some people believe it's true. Some people are still skeptical. No matter what, they're going to believe that the government is not telling them the truth under any circumstances.
Now, these men were caught in a recent shootout in East Amman, we understand.
There was a group of 10 accused terrorists in all. They're affiliated with Al-Qaeda, and 4 or 5 of them were killed in a shootout in East Amman. The remaining 4 or 5 were captured, and these are the interviews that we saw last night.
Yeah, we want to listen to a little bit of the confessions in Arabic, and again, these are men who are alleged to be members of Al-Qaeda, and here is what they said, and then you can translate for us.
ثم بايعت أبو مصعب الزرقاوي على السمع والطاعة وبدون مناقشة.
This is the ringleader of the plot, a Jordanian by the name of Azmi Jayusi. And what he's saying here is that he pledged his full allegiance to Zarqawi with no questions asked, that whatever Zarqawi charged him with, whatever tasks he gave him, Jayusi would carry them out.
But what was the sense of how they were speaking? Did they seem unrepentant? Did they seem to embrace what they were saying?
They spoke, they weren't gloating, but they weren't repentant either. They really believed that what they were doing was the right thing to do. And they were not apologetic about it at all, but they described in a very matter-of-fact way that, yes, they bought 20 tons of chemicals. Yes, they planned on creating a toxic cloud that would kill people in up to a 2-kilometer radius all around. And this is because they wanted to attack the institutions of the Jordanian state and the American embassy and undermine both of those institutions.
This has to be a pretty shocking moment in Jordan.
It is, but what is most shocking is this mini 20-minute documentary that aired last night. I mean, people are absolutely stunned that the government essentially created a documentary showing exactly the safe house where they operated, the metal workshop that they bought where they were putting together the chemical bomb, and all of their interviews were in the form of a documentary, were on the air for people to see and judge for themselves.
That was probably
the most shocking.
Are people not used to that transparency? Is that what you're saying? Or?
Yeah, there was, for example, there was the Millennium Plot that in 1999 that Al-Qaeda led to destabilize Jordan, to target Israeli and American and Jordanian targets here as at the turn of the millennium. There was a group that was caught. They were thrown in jail. They were tried. We didn't hear very much. We only heard the government's version of events. No one was allowed to interview the accused. They were convicted, and they're now in jail. So we saw nothing about any of the procedures. And now we're seeing in detail exactly how they plan to destabilize Jordan. And this has the effect, because they wanted to kill so many thousands of civilians, this has the added effect of, you know, scaring people here into believing that, yes, terrorism can affect you too, not just the state.
Well, Kristen Gillespie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And thank you for your help in bringing us the sound from Jordan TV.
You're welcome. Take care.
Freelance reporter Kristen Gillespie speaking to us from Amman, Jordan.
The Bush administration and United Nations have frequently been at odds over policies in Iraq. But when Lakhdar Brahimi reports today to the Security Council on his plans for an Iraqi interim government, both the U.S. and U.N. are expected to follow his lead. The 70-year-old Brahimi is a former Algerian foreign minister and a longtime Arab diplomat who earlier this year finished a grueling 2-year stint as the U.N.'s liaison to Afghanistan. We're joined now by Julian Borger. He's Washington correspondent for The Guardian newspaper of London. Welcome, Julian.
Thank you.
What's the latest on how Brahimi envisions an Iraqi interim government that will replace, of course, the U.S.-led coalition provisional authority July 1st?
Well, he laid out the overall plan earlier this month, and the idea is to have government of a prime minister and then a figurehead president and two vice presidents, some ministers and a national conference to advise them. But it's going to be a government very much limited in what it is supposed to be doing. It's supposed to be minding the shop until there are elections early next year, not a government that is supposed to take dramatic new directions in policy.
Yeah, still, though, a delicate business cobbling this together. And Brahimi's made explosive remarks, Julian, about Israel in recent days, saying Israeli policy is the great poison in the Middle East. As the Bush administration's point man for creating Iraqi democracy, what do you think he's up to, choosing this moment to criticize the Middle East's most democratic country?
My impression is that it came out in the course of an interview, and of course it just reflects widespread Arab opinion. He was talking about Arab opinion at the time. Of course, you know, in terms of establishing his credibility in Iraq, it will do him a whole lot of good. And the fact that Israel is complaining about it will do him a whole lot of good in terms of his credibility in selling this plan inside Iraq, because the conspiracy theorists inside Iraq will see whatever is going on as a U.S.-backed plan to promote and protect Israel. So in real terms, although they were obviously not very diplomatic remarks, it can only have helped the overall credibility of whatever plan comes out of this when it comes to implementation in Iraq. But that is going to be very difficult, because this interim government is obviously going to face the same problem as the Iraqi Governing Council. It's going to be there under the umbrella of U.S. troops, U.S. security, and therefore it'll be tainted by that umbrella.
And Secretary of State Colin Powell making it clear in recent days that only so much sovereignty will be ceded to Iraq.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in a way, it's a reflection of the obvious reality that if U.S. commanders are calling the shots on the ground, and it is the security is first and foremost the main problem facing the country, then obviously sovereignty and the power of this new government is going to be limited. And that's something that Brahimi has admitted as well. The question is whether this new government, this new interim government, will be seen as having any legitimacy apart from the U.S. security forces if security remains in U.S. hands. And it's hard to imagine Washington giving up control of its forces. Well, I mean, that's a given.
Finally, Julian, and just very briefly, will the U.N. Security Council vote on his propositions?
No, it's a report back today. I mean, at some point, yeah, there's expected to be a resolution that will pave the way for this new interim council, and the U.S. has backed such a resolution, and that seems likely at this moment.
Julian Borger is a reporter for London's Guardian newspaper. He spoke to us from Washington. Julian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Just ahead, President Bush announces his plan to boost technological innovation and create high-tech jobs. Critics say it's an election year gimmick.
And later in the show, protecting the country's nuclear weapons sites.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Hydrogen trucks and farm equipment. Electronic prescriptions so that pharmacists won't have to decipher a doctor's scribble. And high-speed internet access in every home by 2007. Well, these are just some of the proposals outlined by President George Bush this week in a plan that he says will boost technological innovation in the U.S. But critics, including presumptive Democratic nominee John Kerry, call it election year grandstanding. Well, joining us on the line to talk about just one of President Bush's proposals, broadband access, is Declan McCullough. He's D.C. bureau chief for CNetNews.com. And Declan, first of all, how is the industry reacting to the president's plans?
With a guarded optimism, as you sort of might expect. What Bush's proposal is in terms of its high-speed internet access components, it's saying, hey, let's have lower taxes, lower regulation. Let's basically get the federal government out of the way so we can give every American the chance to have their homes wired with high-speed internet access if they want it by the year 2007.
Well, right now only 24 million Americans have broadband, which is a faster and, you know, more expensive internet access at home. How is he suggesting that the government might help? I mean, it is a government plan, so what is he saying he would do to clear the way?
Well, a few things. One thing he did was order federal agencies to make it easier for companies to get access to federal land, let's say if they want to run fiber optic cables along it. And he's also throwing his weight behind FCC Chairman Michael Powell. I mean, this might not mean much outside of Washington, but inside the Capitol, it's hugely important. Chairman Powell is one of the most deregulatory FCC chairmen that who have come along in a while. So Bush is explicitly backing Powell's proposals.
Well, some would say that the Bush announcement is just a preemptive strike against John Kerry. The Wall Street Journal wrote that yesterday. John Kerry is expected to release his high-tech plans soon, and a Kerry advisor says it's going to take a more regulatory approach. From your vantage point, what can you see as the difference between the two men?
It seems as though Kerry wants more government spending, and the only way you get more government spending is to raise taxes or take the money from somewhere else. While Bush is really true to his principles in general, he's saying get the government out of the way and let the private sector build things out, give them incentives to bring high-speed access to people's homes, which might mean things like ripping up sidewalks and putting in fiber. That costs a lot of money, and so you need to provide the right incentives.
We also read in one of your recent articles that Kerry, in suggesting a more regulatory approach, might suggest that broadband be subsidized by wealthier areas for other areas.
That's right. It's unclear whether that's going to make it into Kerry's expected speech. But what that would do, if it makes its way in there, is to say that broadband falls under the U.S. government's category of universal service. And the way that works is it's much more expensive to, say, run telephone lines out into the middle of nowhere than to run them down a city block. And so it results in city dwellers paying higher monthly phone bills to subsidize rural and low-income customers. And so that would work the same way in broadband you'd expect.
Mm. Couldn't a response to that be, why should anyone subsidize anything? Why can't the companies figure it out themselves? Some of these new technology companies are making buckets of money on broadband and cable.
That's a great point. The standard counter-argument when we're talking about, you know, copper wire and an analog phone line has been that it costs so much for that last mile or 10 miles when we're talking about someone out in the countryside that it becomes uneconomical for companies to do it. They just won't run the wire because they can't make enough money from a $20 a month subscription out in the middle of the fields.
Mm-hmm.
But the nice thing is that with the Internet, the same economics don't apply. You can have satellite Internet connections for as low as $50 or so a month, and you can also have wireless. And so the technology doesn't really has changed the dynamic a little.
There are dozens of states that have moved to pass laws authorizing new Internet taxes. Nobody has done that yet. Is there a sense that that's anywhere in the future?
That's a great question. Congress has banned states from taxing Internet access, that is, you know, cable modems, dial-up, and so on, singling out those types of connections with special taxes. But that ban expired on November 1st of last year, and since then, politicians have been scrambling to try to get a majority of the Senate to go along with one proposal or another, but it's sort of been deadlocked, and the debate is resuming this week for the first time in about half a year.
But Declan, in your opinion, is it realistic that poor rural areas would be able to afford high-speed access without any help from either the government or taxes or some source of revenue?
I think the answer is yes. The reality is that Internet connections to the home are 99.9% owned by private corporations, run by private corporations, and even in very far-flung areas, you can find some form of high-speed access. Even the White House says that 90% of Americans have the choice of high-speed access at home, but as it turns out, only a relatively small percentage of those folks choose to actually pay the extra $20 or $30 a month for it. In other words, they're saying that, hey, maybe Internet access at work is good enough, or I'll just have a slow dial-up connection at home.
Mm. Yeah, I guess that's another question I have. Why is this such a big deal? Why has this become a political football when, in fact, so few people have broadband at home?
I think it's an easy thing for politicians to wrap their minds around. Internet is good, therefore more internet is better. But in reality, folks might want to do other things with their money. What happens if they decide to put the money into, say, their kids' college fund instead, or even take a vacation with it? I think for the politicians to say in the sort of top-down Washington way, hey, Americans really should have high-speed internet access, it's almost trying to make a choice for the tens of millions of American families out there instead of letting them make it up themselves.
Hmm. Declan, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
Declan McCullough, D.C. Bureau Chief for CNetNews.com.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the European Union's environment minister talks to us about their approach to global warming.
And celebrating the life of choreographer George Balanchine. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A new Department of Energy directive makes several U.S. nuclear weapons sites more vulnerable to terrorist attacks. This, according to testimony today from a nonprofit, nonpartisan watchdog group speaking before a House subcommittee on nuclear security. We spoke earlier to Danielle Bryan, executive director of the Project for Government Oversight, or POGO. We asked what she wanted to communicate to the committee.
The big problem is we have plutonium and highly enriched uranium spread out across the country at 10 different sites, and there simply is not adequate security at these sites to prevent a serious terrorist attack at them.
And you also write that a new Department of Energy directive makes several nuclear weapon sites indefensible against terrorist attacks. What did you mean by that?
Those sites are now required to prevent a terrorist from even entering the site because the fear had been that a terrorist might try to steal the material. What we have been arguing, and they are finally accepting as the truth, is what you have is suicidal terrorists getting into the site have the potential of creating what's called an improvised nuclear device at the site within minutes, and that's what needs to be protected against.
So has the emphasis switched from preventing someone from entering or leaving with material to preventing someone from entering and then using the material
exactly.
to blow up the site? Has that happened?
Well, the emphasis has changed, but the reality is they haven't been able to implement those requirements yet because you've got aging facilities, you've got fence lines that are too close to the facilities that need to be protected, and those are the things that we're now anxiously pushing for change.
Yeah.
You really want to push the government, but at the same time, you obviously don't want to create a roadmap for terrorists.
Mm. Well, with what you can tell us, what are your fears?
First of all, you don't need to have the materials spread out at all these different sites. They were built during the Cold War not to house materials, but as, for example, for production facilities to have the materials move through and on their way to being made into weapons. Now they're just sitting there being stored for decades in aging buildings. They need to be moved out of those sites. What we are arguing is 6 different sites need to be essentially de-inventoried. Get the plutonium and highly enriched uranium out of those sites completely and into the underground facilities that we own, which can be far more effectively protected.
In other words, if I may, don't spend all your energy on trying to prevent a terrorist from getting in a plant and possibly using the materials inside to blow up the facility. Get those materials out of the facility.
Right. Yeah. That's exactly right.
How do you know what you know?
We work with insiders. We work with whistleblowers and other people who are working at the facilities, who evaluate the facilities, and who are contractors there, all of whom have great concerns. But the bureaucracy doesn't like change. We have one example of a part of Los Alamos, which is Technical Area 18. It's built at the bottom of a canyon. And when Bill Richardson was the Secretary of Energy, he actually ordered to move the materials out of that facility. And, you know, he was the secretary, so because he said it, he thought it was done. Well, Los Alamos didn't want to do that.
Why?
What we're finding at these facilities is it's sort of like fiefdom. They feel more important, essentially, having these materials, even when they're just simply sitting in vaults, not being used at all. In the case of Los Alamos, they just outwaited the secretary. He left, and they dug their heels in, and not a speck moved because of that. We're very pleased. We've actually met with Secretary Abraham. He was very responsive to the recommendations that we made to him. We're hoping he will implement them. But he did make the first step of announcing he is going to do what Secretary Richardson asked to have done many years ago, is get rid of the stuff at that part of Los Alamos.
Hmm. Well, Danielle Bryan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Danielle Bryan, Executive Director of the Project for Government Oversight, or POGO. She's testifying today before the House Subcommittee hearing on nuclear security.
Imagine liquid armor that can protect against bullets, knives, and other weapons, but that's also so flexible it can protect arms and legs that, because they need to move in combat, are usually left unprotected. It's not the stuff of futuristic comic books. Liquid armors in development at the University of Delaware. Joining us on the line is Dr. Eric Wetzel, one of the creators of so-called liquid armor. He's a mechanical engineer at the Weapons and Materials Research Directorate at the Army Research Laboratory. He joins us from Aberdeen, Maryland. And, Doctor, liquid armor, is it wet?
I guess I'd call it sticky more than wet. You can flow it kind of like, let's say, shampoo or kind of warm honey.
What is it?
It's actually a suspension of very small silica particles, basically glass particles, in polyethylene glycol, which is kind of like antifreeze, but a little bit goopier, let's say.
And where do you put this sort of semi-liquid glop?
Well, what we actually do is impregnate it or soak it into fabric. The armors that are right now used for most body armor, like our soldiers wear, like police officers wear, is a woven fabric of, let's say, Kevlar, you might have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
What we do is actually soak this fluid into the fabric, so the fabric kind of supports it. And, in fact, we don't add so much such that there's a big, let's say, puddle of liquid sitting there, but, in fact, it's just kind of soaked into the fabric. It makes it a little bit sticky, a little bit glossy.
You soak Kevlar fabric or just any particular kind of fabric?
Right now we use Kevlar because that's the standard material that's used for body armor. It's the most commonly used one, but it could be used for pretty much any type of fabric armor.
Doctor, how did you come up with this kind of pancake battery semi-liquid that can make Kevlar more impregnable than ever before?
Well, I guess this came out of discussions with Professor Norman Wagner at the University of Delaware, who's worked with these type of fluids for many years, these shear thickening fluids, they call them. The fluids have these interesting properties that they kind of flow like a liquid if you're pouring them slowly, but if you try to pour them or deform them quickly, they rigidize and sort of act like a stiff gel. And it seemed intuitive that you could use those for a ballistics application where you want a material that is soft, conformable when you're walking around or bending your arms or legs, but when it's impacted with something like a knife or a bullet, it rigidizes and hopefully gives you more protection. So based on that concept, we started playing around with some things, and indeed it seems to be providing some of the effects we predicted.
Doctor, how far away are we from actually being able to supply troops with this?
That's a great question. We're certainly working hard on it every day. We have some tests underway, and if they go very positively, there's a good chance we could push it forward in the near future, but it's hard to say for sure.
Hmm. Within a year, possibly?
I would say that's possible, but it's very hard to promise at this point.
And finally, speaking of tests, I bet you're thinking of civilian applications, too.
Of course. In fact, the civilian applications might be more immediate. For example, one of the best things that we've demonstrated is to be able to stop puncture threats, like stabbing an ice pick through this material is very difficult. And for correctional officers or prison guards, their number one threat is actually getting stabbed by improvised knives and picks and things. So the type of protection that we have created would probably be ideal for that situation.
Dr. Eric Wetzel is a mechanical engineer at the Weapons and Materials Research Directorate. Dr. Wetzel, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Still to come, guitarist and Uber collaborator Bill Frisell.
Uber collaborator. You're listening to Here and Now. A key political primary in Pennsylvania today. The latest polls show the race between incumbent Republican Senator Arlen Specter and his primary challenger, Representative Patrick Toomey, is very close in what many see as a referendum on the two wings of the Republican Party. Four-term Senator Specter is considered a centrist. Three-term Congressman Toomey is a conservative. Though, interestingly, conservative President Bush is supporting the moderate Specter. Well, joining us from the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia is WHYY reporter Brenda Jurette. Welcome, Brenda.
Hello. Good to be with you.
Who is Patrick Toomey?
Patrick Toomey is quite the conservative. If you go by all of his voting records as well as his ads, as he has been on the attack against Arlen Specter, he's much younger than Specter. Specter is 74 years old, and Pat Toomey at 42 years old, and has put together sort of a grassroots volunteer network, conservative ideological groups. There are the abortion opponents, evangelical Christians, gun owners, and some of the Republicans who've been disenchanted with Specter after his 24 years in office.
Toomey has supported the Bush administration more from his position in the House than Specter's support of the president from his position in the Senate. So why is President Bush been in Pennsylvania campaigning for Arlen Specter?
Specter has always painted himself as more of an independent. The key thing that's going to go on here is the belief that if Toomey wins, then he will lose, Toomey will lose in November, which I believe would scare the Republicans a lot more than having Specter, the more moderate independent candidate or senator, still in office.
With the Senate so closely divided, 51-48, obviously every seat counts. Brenda, who is the Republican nominee likely to face in November?
The unopposed candidate on the Democratic side is Congressman Joe Huffle, and he left his congressional seat to take on whoever wins this primary. He's sort of a mid-range Democratic candidate, a liberal, if you will, and he's very popular, sort of the polar opposite of Specter and certainly of Toomey. It's clearly believed that Huffle would have a much better chance against Toomey than he would against Specter.
Now, Specter, I read, was as much as 18 points ahead of Toomey just a few weeks ago. Now
yes.
The polls show Toomey behind him, but practically in the margin of error, just 5 or 6 points. What happened?
I think money played into it, Bill. $15 million has been spent on this campaign, and then $300,000 was pumped in from the Republicans supporting Specter on the national level just in the past week or so because they're running a little bit scared. Toomey was well-financed and had a lot of money from a lot of these conservative groups that are supporting him. Club for Growth is one of them, an ultra-conservative group as well. So I think that's where the Quinnipiac University poll that came out yesterday gave Specter a 6-point lead with 10% undecided. That could be the key today. We've got good weather across Pennsylvania. I believe they're expecting about 1 million Republicans of the 3.1 million who are registered in the state.
Brenda, has there been a main issue driving this primary, or is it really about ideology?
It is about ideology, and it's been about Toomey pushing his conservative platform, anti-abortion, while Specter is certainly pro-choice, and that is something that the Republican Party has always been a little bit skittish about when it came to Arlen Specter.
Key primary in a key state this fall. Brenda Jurette is senior producer and host of Morning Edition for WHYY in Philadelphia. Brenda, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks very much.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Where the Olympics started in Athens, Greece, the question right now is whether the main stadium for this summer's Olympics will be completely finished in time. A key deadline looms tomorrow. Correspondent Tim Malloy is in Athens this week preparing a report on the Olympics for the Scripps Howard television stations. And Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Bill.
Tim, a deadline looming for the Olympic Stadium tomorrow, right? And it's all about the roof.
It is. It's an 18,000-ton Olympic Stadium roof over the main big stadium, and it's been delayed and delayed and delayed because of bad weather and humidity, and now we're hearing that they're hoping to get it done tomorrow. If not, they could have problems with getting it done at all.
And it's a question about sliding two massive arches in place in time, right?
Yeah, a Spanish architect put this together, very controversial. Some people think it's the greatest thing since the Parthenon. Some people think it's an atrocity, but it's two giant, like, half shells coming together to meet in the middle on giant tracks. And I was over there, and it doesn't look ready. And they're both in position a good deal away from each other on either side of the stadium.
What's the problem if there's no roof on the main Olympic stadium?
They're very, very worried about security here. All of Europe is. And I spent part of yesterday with Wackenhut, one of the main policing agencies here doing security, and they're concerned if we don't know what the stadiums really are going to look like, it's going to be hard to protect them. So that's sort of one of the subplots of this is the security issue. And if the venues aren't the way they should be, how do we keep people safe?
Tim, if they don't get these two massive arches swung in place for this 18,000-ton steel roof by tomorrow, why can't they just do it a week later?
It's complicated architecturally. My understanding is it's also 70 meters high. It's massive. It creeps slowly together. I believe they figure that this is sort of their last deadline has run out. They've had several. I think this is their last shot at it.
Tim Malloy is a correspondent for the Scripps Howard television stations. He joined us from Athens. Tim, thanks a lot.
Okay, Bill.
If you Google guitarist Bill Frisell, you'll find dozens of websites dedicated to deciphering his unusual physical technique. And as his many fans have found, it's not easy to figure out a genre either. Bill Frisell is painfully shy and soft-spoken in person, but speaks clearly with his guitar to musicians around the world, collaborating with artists as varied as Elvis Costello, Ginger Baker, John Scofield, and Marianne Faithfull. Frisell has also worked with filmmaker Gus Van Sant, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Brian Eno, and Ricky Lee Jones. Frisell with Ricky Lee Jones on her 2003 recording The Evening of My Best Day. His most recent CD features yet another partnership, this one with Petra Hayden, daughter of jazz great Charlie Hayden. They cover everything from Elliott Smith to Coldplay to the Mancini-Mercer classic Moon River.
Oh, dream.
Frisell and Petra Hayden. And by the way, Bill's other recent release is a world music offering. It's called The Intercontinentals. It was nominated for a Grammy. How does he have the time to talk to us? Well, guitarist Bill Frisell does join us now from the studios of KUOW in Seattle, where he makes his home. Hello, Bill.
Hi.
I've been trying to describe your sound to people. Others have tried as well. They say it sometimes it sounds like a slide guitar. It's uniquely you. How about the technical aspect of the guitar you play, which lends itself to that sound? It has a flexible neck. What does that mean for you?
Oh, it doesn't really. It's really coming from just trying to get it in tune, especially when you play more than one note. One of those notes is going to be somehow off, somehow. And so I sort of bend the neck one way or another to tighten or loosen it. And then that one note will come in tune, but then all the other notes will go out of tune. So then I move it back. So it's sort of this constant fighting with the thing.
How would you describe Bill Frisell growing up? I mean, what was your life like? And you know, because there are so many people who want to be you. Who are you?
Well, sometimes people say, you know, I grew up in Colorado, and then they talk about the open spaces and the whatever that influence on the music, and it sounds good. But the reality is, I mean, I grew up in Denver in the middle of the city, basically. And, you know, in the 50s and 60s, in a sort of middle-class American kind of leave it to Beaver-like situation. Mm-hmm. Not quite that, but I was lucky that my parents and so many people around me allowed me to follow through with some of this stuff. I mean, I think back, I had friends in school that I played in bands with, and I remember what struggle they had with their parents just not wanting them to go out and play gigs or in clubs or even just, you know, thinking that whatever kind of music we were playing was some kind of evil thing or something. But, you know, I never had that problem. I've always had a lot of support.
We want to mention your other CD that's out now with Petra Hayden, daughter of the fabulous bass player Charlie Hayden. So you're now playing with the second generation of some of your jazz heroes.
Yeah, that's wild, too. She's just extraordinary, amazing musician.
She's one of so many. I mean, Ricky Lee Jones, David Sanborn, Brian Eno, also a banjo player from Seattle named Danny Barnes. There's a big fan of Danny's here. His music is sort of punk bluegrass. He used to be with the band The Bad Livers.
Yeah, Danny's amazing.
Is there anyone that you haven't played with that is sort of, you know, oh boy, if I could just play with them?
Oh, I mean, there's millions of people. There's people that I've never heard or heard of that I'm sure I'd like to play with.
But and name, then there's, name one. No, name one of
well,
them.
Well, I mean, I guess, do they have to be alive? I mean, there's, no, there's
yes,
still.
Yes, they would for you to play with them.
Like Sonny Rollins or Wayne Shorter or Bob Dylan or Neil Young or Merle Haggard or Dolly Parton, Ornette Coleman. I could go on probably all day. But it's not just famous big name people, you know, there's just everywhere there's music, you know.
Well, Bill, something tells me that if they hear, they'll be calling. Bill Frisell, thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. guitarist Bill Frisell. For information on his current tour, visit our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.